The Fan on Demand. Cooler than Math Club and almost as cool as Chess Club. The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
To you, this is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Gary Mello. Sportsnet Magazine, so much to get to today, as there always is. Saturday's maybe the best day ever to talk about sports. You know what's the best day ever? No matter what you're talking about. And we're happy to be here talking sports with you. We're going to get to the Jays marginally. it's another season of looking ahead to next year and projecting the future and looking at the young players. We'll get to the NFL and Roger Goodell. Oh man, times continue to be tough for him. But let's start with the National Hockey League, and the big board outside these studios reads 18 days until the start of the National Hockey League season. Camps are open. That means the Toronto Maple Leafs are on the ice. They're working out. Phil Kessel's trying to kill off that last 15 pounds, apparently, or not. Apparently, he's good with it on. Already, we're getting some hilarious storylines coming out of Maple Leafs camp. But it raises, let's start with the bare basics with the Maple Leafs. Expectations going into this season, guys, because this is a team 2 years ago, we know they exceeded expectations, taking the Boston Bruins to seven games. I don't even know how that seventh game ended. I've erased that memory. I think a lot of people have. From their minds. Last year, they were in nice position. Jonathan Bernier goes down. They completely collapse. I think we'd all agree the Eastern Conference is kind of wide open, but the offseason acquisitions don't exactly get you all that jacked up, although David Clarkson would have last year. So that all being said, the new regime that's in place, this team looking forward, what do we expect, Gary?
Well, I don't think the expectations are very high this year. I mean, like you said, the offseason moves weren't very sexy. Certainly no David Clarkson signings there. But, you know, one of their biggest issues last year was the defensive play. And I don't think they've improved very much on defense. You know, they brought in Roman Polak and they brought in Stefan Robidas. You can argue that Polak is not an upgrade over Gunnarsson. I actually can say he's a downgrade. So I think the real interesting part will be is how they play their defensive hockey this year. You know, Randy Carlyle's got a couple of new assistant coaches in there. It's, you know, last year they were playing a lot of kind of a collapse in their own zone, which made it difficult to get the puck out, and they gave up, a league high shots against. So it's, I think how they adapt there is probably going to dictate how well they do out of the gates.
Yeah. I mean, like you say, I think you look at this team and the blue line is such a glaring issue at this point already. And, you know, a lot of people are talking about the Leafs as a perennial kind of seventh, eighth seed playoff contender.
Yeah.
They have the strong front line, Kessel and Bozak and Lupo, who do produce. And obviously, Bernier was really solid last year.
And James Van Riemsdyk had a breakout season.
That's right. That's right. So, I mean, there's talent, especially up front. But, I mean, when you look at the depth, when you look at the defensive kind of lapses, I think this team's going to be really tough to even fight for that playoffs.
Well, and it raises the question, right? Because that's 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, really. 9th, 10th is the worst spot you can be in,
yes,
which...
In any sport, yeah.
The Maple Leafs are perennially... Right there, 9th and 10th. So there was talk that, you know, are the Leafs kind of like quietly in the Connor McDavid possibility sweepstakes? I mean, they're too good to be in the hunt for Connor McDavid, aren't they?
I think so, and I think it's a hard market to sell that to your fan
really
base.
You think so?
Well, I mean, listen, it's the fact that there's no guarantees. I mean, when you look at the talent on this team, that you're going to have to dump some players that they have now or get lucky, quote-unquote lucky, and have a bunch of guys get injured for that to happen. I mean, this team's just not positioned for that at the moment. I mean, they're, like you said, they're too good to be in the McDavid race. In my opinion, not good enough to be in the playoff race. They're in the absolute no-man's land where you don't want to be.
But if you have a goalie, and I think Maple Leafs do.
Yeah.
And you can pretty much point to Jonathan Bernier's injury on the West Coast last year and them falling off a cliff. And, you know, James Reimer, pretty solid backup if he's not starting every game. But if you got a top 10 goalie and you've got a top line that's top 10, maybe top 5 in the National Hockey League, second line, you know, there's a possibility of some goodness there. Isn't that a team that, especially in the Eastern Conference, should be in the playoffs?
Yeah, I mean, I think they'll definitely be in the playoff race. But at the same time, you can't be riding a goalie for 82 games of the season. Like, it's one thing to ride a hot goalie in the playoffs.
Yeah.
But we saw it last year. You know, when Bernier was good for them, they were winning games. But their style of play didn't allow them to carry that over 82 games.
They were like, firmly in dead last for shots allowed. I think it was, like, almost 36
right.
a game.
Yeah.
I mean, it's insane. It was, like, 11 or 12 worse than the top team. I don't know how you can have success doing that. I don't think, like, to put Bernier in that situation again, it's kind of a risky proposition.
But this is supposed to be a new team, right? This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis, Dave Zarum, and Gary Mello. This is supposed to be a new Maple Leafs team as far as a philosophy is concerned, right? Because you've got the analytics guys in place. You've got Randy Carlyle's right-hand men, who Randy Carlyle didn't ask for, but he was kind of given right. his right-hand man. This is a team that is supposed to be more worried about puck possession, controlling the pace and the flow of play more than they were last year. And I guess, you know, we don't have to rehash it, but last year the nerds won, right? The analytics people beat out the non-analytics people, the people that said, oh, look at the Corsi Hockey League isn't too happy with the Maple Leafs being in the position that they are. And people said, well, it's probably not sustainable to just keep scoring on the rush and not have puck possession.
Yep.
Now, it's one thing to bring guys in place in an off season, Kyle Dubas and his ilk. How much of an effect can that have on the ice the next season, Dave, when you're trying to project this team being able to control the puck more? Is Kyle Dubas going to be able to change the Corsi numbers of this Maple Leafs team in one off season?
No, I mean, I think the advantage of bringing guys like that in is you know, long-term future. When you look at the kind of prospects they go after, the guys they're scouting from that perspective. In terms of what they do on the ice right now, it really comes down to the players and the coaching staff, and I don't know how much influence Kyle Dubas has on that at all. And you know, the interesting thing is, for that to happen, for you know the team to go towards that puck possession trend or make any changes on the ice, the players need to buy in, right? And hasn't there already been some kind of resistance to that one day into training camp?
Yeah, it wouldn't be Toronto without a little controversy before training camp even started. Yeah, Steve Spott, new assistant head coach, if you didn't see the story, Dave Festchuk writing it in the Toronto Star, that Steve Spott, who was the head coach of the Toronto Marlies last year, now an assistant with the Maple Leafs this year. He was talking to a bunch of minor league coaches in a conference and talked about trying to implement a new breakout scheme for the Maple Leafs and posed it to Phil Kessel. And Phil said, nah, I'm not doing that. He said, okay, you're Phil Kessel. I guess I can't force you to do it. So already we've got the specter of some of these key players in Phil Kessel. And Phil kind of denied the fact that he even talks hockey in the offseason after being asked this question.
Or plays it.
Yeah, he doesn't do anything. Apparently he was on the ice 5 times is what he said this offseason. He was more concerned about fishing and golf, which is fine if you come back and score 30 goals perennially, which he tends to do. But is there going to be a pushback? We always think about the pushback coming from Randy Carlyle to the nerds, right? To the Kyle Dubases of the world. It's Randy Carlyle who's going to say, nah, it's not how we do things. I'm an old school guy. Get your abacus out of here. But maybe there's a player pushback, Gary, from the likes of a Phil Kessel or guys that are, you know, Phil Kessel and James Van Riemsdyk. That's pretty scary, those two guys coming down on the rush. If they're going to try and eliminate that, have them play a little more conservatively, maybe you get a pushback from the players.
I don't think so. I mean, I imagine this happens probably a little bit more often than we hear about, but because we're in Toronto, a story like that is going to get out when you have anonymous minor hockey coaches going on the record with a reporter. But I imagine that, you know, they can't exactly do the same things they were doing last year. I mean, all Steve Spott has to do is point to the record in the standings last year and say, well, if this wasn't working, we got to try new things. I know Phil Kessel's a special character. He's got so much skill. He's got so much speed. So he's the type of player that wants to be up ice to get the puck fed to him. But I'm sure he'll be open to some change this year.
What is, I mean, Phil Kessel is such a polarizing guy, right? I love to talk about him because he is so skilled. And there's so much that you can point to and you know, people take one side or the other with him, right? The comment that, again, from anonymous minor league coaches that Steve Spott said he's probably 15 pounds overweight, which makes what he does even that much more impressive. He is a pudgy-looking guy. He doesn't really speak to the media. I actually kind of enjoyed his media conference when he was talking about these comments from Steve Spott. He was getting a little bit... I kind of like the angry Phil Kessel when he's talking to the media. He doesn't talk to them very much, and usually when he does, he's not saying much, but he was actually angry and chewing his gum in an angry fashion. But he's a guy that is polarizing to... But maybe it's just to the media that he's polarizing to, because fans, do they really care? Like the general Maple Leaf fan, do they care that that Phil Kessel's 15 pounds overweight, or that he doesn't get along with Steve Spott or doesn't speak to the media, Dave?
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point. I mean, yeah, I kind of think that maybe the fans probably don't care whether he does scrums after the game or not, you know? And that's something that in the media, you're going to look at that and say, well, he's making my job more difficult, so... You know, I have this issue with that aspect of it. But for the fans, I mean, all they want is their guy to produce, right? And he has produced. I mean, you think of that the playoffs, the series against Boston, whatnot. I mean, he was coming up huge.
Oh yeah,
huge for them. So I mean, how can you not appreciate that if you're a fan of this team? And, I mean, he is a total character. I mean, he's a kind of a different breed, and I could see how it rubs some people the wrong way. But I mean, I like it. I think I've kind of really come around, kind of embracing guys. Vibe. I don't know how else to say it.
I think there are definitely sections of the fan base, though, that don't love Phil Kessel. I mean, if you look at the history of the Maple Leafs in the city, you know, the city tends to embrace the Ty Domies and the Doug Gilmores and the players with a little bit of grit, you know, even the Colton Orrs and that type of stuff, Wendell Clark. So, I mean, Phil Kessel is not going to give you that type of play. But the weight one is an interesting one because, yeah, he comes in 15 pounds overweight. I'm sure, A, he's not the only player who comes in overweight to training camp. And B, I mean, this is a guy who hasn't missed a game in 4 seasons. Like, are we really concerned about his, you know, his offseason training if, you know, he hasn't had any injury concerns in 4 years and he's producing? Like, he's a consistent 30-35 goal scorer. So as long as you're getting that production from him, it's not a concern. And my concern, if I'm a Leaf fan, is that it's more long-term. I mean, he's got $8 million a year for, you know, a huge contract extension. I'd be a little bit more concerned when he starts getting to the 31, 32 age and coming in, you know, a little 50. Bit overweight where he can't just ride his natural skill. But right now, it doesn't seem to be an issue with Phil Kessel.
Yeah, that's a great point in terms of kind of what it looks like a few years down the line. But I mean, the weight thing, I mean, we see guys even across other sports, you think like Charles Barkley, guys like that, who kind of defy their body type.
I'm glad you didn't say you look at guys even in this room right now, a little 15 pounds overweight.
No, I just thought it, but you know, yeah. I didn't verbalize it.
Yeah, Charles Barkley, one of those guys who was always overweight.
Yeah. I mean, there's such a long list of guys who they don't look like they can perform the way they do, and then they obviously have the ability to do so. So
yeah. Yeah, it is... it's an interesting one, but I think, Gary, that point is well made, mm-hmm. that it's one thing to do that in your 20s. It's another thing to have a long career and be Dustin Penner and still eating pancakes.
You know? Exactly. And I think, you know, I look at Danny Heatley all the time. Like, here's a guy who, you know, rode his natural skill early on in his career. You know, he scored 50 goals back-to-back seasons, but then he kind of peaked at 26. And, you know, from what I've heard, he's not a gym rat either. Mm-hmm. So as he gets a little bit older and he loses a step, that's where you really start to struggle later on in your career. So I just hope Kessel doesn't go that route.
So I touched kind of a little bit on the offseason acquisitions, and none of them, you know, blowing you away. Like that big David Clarkson acquisition a couple years ago just blew you away. The Maple Leafs went out and got a guy who's going to score 30 goals for him, except not really. But David Clarkson, maybe we should start with him before we get to some of the other guys that are, I don't know, interesting maybe, and not a whole lot of risk with guys like Mike Santarelli and Daniel Winnick and the like. But David Clarkson can't be as bad, right? Like, the expectations are at zero for David Clarkson. He's got a lot to prove. Isn't it possible that David Clarkson surprises a little bit? No?
I don't think so. I mean, A, it's going to be tougher to be worse than last year.
Yeah.
And B, there's still got to be a lot of pressure on him coming in. I mean, the one thing working in his favor is last year got off to a horrible start with getting the 10-game suspension for a preseason game and coming off the bench. So, I mean, I can't imagine he starts the season any worse. So as long as he starts off on the right foot, it'll be interesting to see whether or not the Leafs slot him on the second line alongside a Kadri and a Lupul, or whether or not he starts a little bit lower in the line. So,
But you think of Kadri and Lupul, those guys have so much speed, right? Like, that's their game is speed. David Clarkson, even when he was scoring a bunch of goals, wasn't doing it with speed. Isn't that guy just clogging up that line if you put him on the second line? I know you want to put him in a position where he can succeed, but doesn't seem like that would be beneficial to either Lupul or Kadri.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of seems like a perfect kind of prototypical third line guy. He looks like he'd fit there. Obviously, maybe because of his contract, there'd be reason to give him more ice time, get him up on the kind of higher profile lines, if you want to say it like that. But, you know, as far as like expectations, I mean, I think they're so low that there's nowhere to go from up for Clarkson at this point, right? I mean, last year was kind of a disaster. You know, you mentioned the early start, but like, what was it with him last year? Like, why do you think he was...
I think he was just a lot slower and, you know, a lot of falling down for no reason. It just seemed like a guy who you wonder how on earth did he ever do it before, right? Like, he just looked completely out of sorts all season. Like, it just never looked like this was a guy who scored 30 goals in 80 games with the Devils in 2011, 2012. And I mean, how can you look that bad in a 60-game season for the Toronto Maple Leafs? I have no idea.
Well, I think Ken Danico said it best last year, and he said basically David Clarkson came over from the New Jersey Devils, who play some of the most structured hockey in the NHL, to the Toronto Maple Leafs, who have absolutely no structure.
Yeah, it's true. And you wonder if this is a different style of Leaf team that he plays on. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, 1018 Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis, along with Gary Mello and Dave Zarum of Sportsnet Magazine. So the off-season acquisitions weren't exactly sexy, okay? Daniel Winnick, Petri Kontiola. It's not going to get people pumped up.
Hey, man, Leo Komarov.
Leo Komarov. He's back in POG form. Mike Santarelli, who could be an interesting guy, suffered some injuries with the Canucks as well. Matt Fratton's back. Forwards, though, they got a bunch of them. And I think Maple Leafs have kind of gone with the theory that they're going to go with volume. They're going to go with quantity, if not quality. And they'll hope that there's some quality. I think if you just throw enough darts, eventually one is going to hit, right? And these are all low-risk guys, and some of them with some nice peripheral numbers, possibilities of surprising. Daniel Winnick. I think, considering the market, probably the best move Maple Leafs could have made.
Well, last year, the Leafs certainly weren't rolling four lines out there like most of the top teams in the NHL were. You know, they got most of their offense from that first line, a couple of 30-goal scorers in Kessel and Van Riemsdyk. You had a couple of guys in the 20-goal range, you know, both Lupul and Mason Raymond. And then you had Bozak and Kadri right there on the cusp. I think actually Kadri had 20 goals last year. So Bozak was right on the cusp as well. So I think what they needed to do was add depth to those third and fourth lines, and that's something they've done. You know, and they've been successful in recent years with giving guys one-year contracts or short contracts. I worked with Clark MacArthur a couple of years ago. Mason Raymond was good for them last year. So there's certainly no risk in bringing these players in. And if these guys can eat up some minutes and give them some offense from the bottom lines, or at least a shutdown line, a decent shutdown line.
Or hold on to the puck for, you know, a couple of seconds, that'd be neat.
Then that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't like going this time of year. I think the best teams are going to training camp with kind of defined roles for their guys. They're going in to kind of work the systems and that kind of thing. I'm always hesitant when teams are going in kind of hoping something works out, rolling the dice. Maybe a guy or two will break out like we expect.
There's like, you couldn't, if you were writing down lines right now, maybe the first two you'd be able to figure out. But other than that, like this could be an interesting training camp, interesting preseason, but there's a lot of question marks on this team, especially up front.
Yeah, I mean, it's still undefined. This team's undefined. We know the first line. We know probably the second line and the starting goaltender.
It's like when you divide by zero. They're undefined. The back end.
I don't
end,
get that at all.
No, I know. You failed math. It's okay. The back line, though, is I think we all agree, were the question marks. Most of them. I mean, there's plenty of question marks up front, but the back line is going to be where a whole bunch of question marks lie. They picked up a guy like Stefan Robida, who hopefully doesn't break his leg on the way to MasterCard Center again. He's got a history of doing that. Not walking, but yeah, breaking legs. You've got Roman Polak, who I don't know what he is, really. But you're hoping for another year of development and stepping forward from Morgan Riley and Jake Gardner, starting to figure it out at the end of last year as well. And Dion Phaneuf is Dion Phaneuf, right? We all understand that maybe he's not a $7 million player, okay? But he is to this team because he plays a lot of minutes. He's got a big shot, and he's fine. He eats up some minutes. Did the Maple Leafs do enough on the back end? Is this enough of a defense core to give you some sort of faith going into this season, Dave?
No.
All right, Gary.
I agree with Dave. I think the one thing that the Leafs are hoping for is they've got a little bit more balance on the back line now. They've got three left-handed shots, three right-handed shots. So maybe it's a little bit easier to partner guys up together. And whether or not that affects or helps their defensive play, I don't know. Whether it helps them get the puck out of the zone a little bit faster, I don't know. I don't think the quality's there on the blue line. So whether or not these new partnerships will work is what remains to be seen.
It's a lot of question marks, definitely, on that back end. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Gary Mello. The head coaching situation going into this season, I think, to me, I would have put the odds at 75% that Randy Carlyle was gone at the end of last year. They brought in Brendan Shanahan to oversee the whole thing, kept Randy Carlyle. Now, you can be kind of a cynic and say, well, he did that. That's his escape clause, right? If this team has a rough start or, you know, 82 games and they're pretty lousy, they're not 8th, 7th, they're 9th, 10th, you can axe Randy Carlyle. That's your first bullet. You can fire it. Others would say, hey, listen, Randy Carlyle, you put some other pieces around him. You tell him you've kind of got to change the way you do things. He's a guy who's won a cup before. Yeah, sure, that Ducks team had some talent, to say the least. Maybe this is a guy who can move this Leafs team forward. Which one are you guys? Are you guys the cynic that says Randy Carlyle's, I mean, his days are numbered? Or is this a guy who really could be the head coach of this team when, if they're good at some point, Gary?
Well, I think the Leafs really need to be in a playoff position by the time Christmas rolls around for Randy Carlyle to still have a job, or he's done. You know, you have a head coach who didn't pick his assistant coaches. That's pretty rare in the NHL.
Yeah.
And you look at some of the things that he's done with this team. Are they going to be able to change their defensive schemes if Randy Carlyle's calling shots? How much power is he going to give to his assistant coach to, you know, make decisions and what they play? So it'll be interesting to see. And then you got a coach like Dan Bylsma sitting there. I'm sure the Leafs probably have him on speed dial. If things aren't going well with Randy Carlyle, there's some good candidates out there to bring in.
It really seems like they've kind of undermined both their head coach and their GM, right? Like, here's a head coach, Randy Carlyle. Sure, we'll bring you back, but you don't get to pick any of your assistants. Mm-hmm. We'll pick them for you. We'll kind of tell you how to play, how you have to play if you want a job. Same thing with Dave Nonis. Dave, yeah, you're still the GM. Here's a bunch of young kids, maybe a GM in waiting in Kyle Dubas, a bunch of analytics guys. I know you've never used analytics before, but you're going to use them now. It really does seem like an odd way to go about things. It's like they're firing the head coach and the GM, but not. Like, they're just stripping all their powers and undermining their authority on both fronts there, Dave.
No, it's like you guys said. I mean, they're setting themselves up in a good position where if something does go wrong, they have their fall guys kind of already in place. You know, first of all, I think it's really impressive that we've been talking about the Leafs and we didn't talk about whether or not they're going to fire the coach for 23 minutes.
Yeah, it's true.
It's a record.
Yeah,
on top
of
radio.
Some sort of benchmark. But, you know, obviously, you know, you look at their troubles last year, the defensive lapses, like we were talking about earlier, and you know, how much of that blame has to go on Carlyle, probably a good chunk of it in terms of their systems and whether or not the players are responding to him. That being said, though, I mean, you got to give him players to work with, and yeah, he does have that forward, but I can't stress enough how weak I think this defense is. There's a coach out there who probably can take these guys and make it work, but I mean, you play with the cards you're dealt, right? And right, yeah, now he's got a pretty shady deck.
Yeah, he's got a bunch of twos and sevens, right?
Like, yeah, exactly.
That's lousy. All right, before we take a break here, going into camp. Camp is now open, and preseason games get underway on Monday as the Maple Leafs will play the Flyers in London, and Flyers are the home team for whatever reason. But yes, on Monday, Maple Leafs get their preseason underway, they are actually at home on Tuesday, so back-to-back games. Actually, they play on Wednesday, too. It never ends for the Maple Leafs. Split squad on Wednesday. So going into camp, what are you most interested in? Is it looking at how the forward lines break down? Is it looking at how good Stefan Robida or how bad he looks? Is it making sure that Jonathan Bernier is back to being 100%? What is the major storyline for you for the Maple Leafs headed into training camp, Gary?
Well, I don't know if it's a major storyline, but one thing I'm intrigued to see how it works out is Nazem Kadri.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, I think, a pretty big year for him. You know, I don't think the excuse of being a young player learning the NHL game helps Nazem Kadri anymore. I think it's, you know, we have to see if he's capable of being a first or second line center. You know, he has a history with Randy Carlyle. Randy is not afraid to throw Nazem under the bus. So this is a big year for him. I don't know if he can, you know, strive under a coach like Randy Carlyle, but it'll be a big test for him this year.
What about you, Dave? Yeah, what's the number one storyline?
I'm looking at, you know, you mentioned it, Bernier, whether or not he's completely 100% ready to go in there. I mean, I think he will be, but you just, I expect another year where he's going to be dependent on heavily. So you want to make sure he's kind of good to go.
18 days until the Toronto Maple Leafs host the Montreal Canadiens in the first game of the National Hockey League regular season. Of course, you can watch it on Sportsnet. It's like every other game ever, forever and ever, at least for the next 12 years, probably more. When we come back, Blue Jays lose again, 5-3 to the Yankees yesterday. Their tragic number now down to 4. So any combination of 4 losses or Royals wins will officially eliminate the Blue Jays, but all but done is their season. Mark Burley now 6 innings away from 200. Once again this season, looks like he's going to reach that plateau. Dalton Pompey of Mississauga, his first major league hit. We'll look forward to the offseason for the Blue Jays and whether that does include, perhaps, and it didn't look like it would, but now some rumblings that it might, a change at manager, John Gibbons. Could he be canned in the offseason? That and much more coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Gary Mello. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Ben Nicholson-Smith.
Rendon down the line! It's another game winner for the Nets!
The Washington Nationals have a deep lineup, and no one wants to face that rotation. They might be baseball's best team. But Yankees right-hander Brandon McCarthy has another idea. He says the Dodgers could be the scariest team in the game.
If everybody's clicking, it's not unpitchable, but it's your work is cut out because it's exhausting to get through, you know, 4 of the guys, and then you still get to the back end of that, and now comes Hanley, and now it's Uribe, and you can never let up pitches.
Then again, the way Mike Trout's Angels are playing, the Dodgers might not even be the best team in LA. It's not just the rich teams either. Small market successes like the Brewers and Pirates can't be counted out yet. With just 1 week left in the season and 2 wildcard spots per league up for grabs, the races are wilder than ever. Pick up our Pennant Race issue for an in-depth look at MLB's contenders.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine. Available on newsstands now and for your tablet and mobile phone on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gary Mello and Dave Zarum. Blue Jays lose yesterday, as they are wont to do recently, 5-3 to the Yankees. Now just a single game over 500 at 77-76, putting them on the verge of officially being eliminated from playoff contention. If all goes according to Hoyle for the Royals this weekend, Blue Jays could be officially done by Monday morning when they wake up. Their tragic number down to 4, so a couple losses by them and a couple wins by the Kansas City Royals would officially eliminate the Blue Jays. But there's a lot to talk about when rehashing the season and looking forward to next year. I guess let's start with the manager, because there was that story written a couple months ago about how it was already decided that Alex Anthopoulos and John Gibbons, they would be back next season. We know John Gibbons' contract, the way it is constructed, he has a rolling option. Whenever he completes a year, he gets a bonus year. So it's like the golden parachute. The guy's going to be paid if he gets fired no matter what. Nice little deal. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get one. But new comments from Alex Anthopoulos talking about the possibility of John Gibbons returning. Talked about, yeah, he's the manager because he's under contract. And I'm quoting, he says, in regards to everybody in the organization, quote, you support them until you don't support them, end quote. And it's an interesting conversation, I think, because there's so much that goes into being a Major League Baseball manager. A lot of it is, sure, in-game managing, pinch hitting, bullpen usage, filling out the lineup card, all that. But there's something else, isn't there? And maybe there's not, but it seems like there is, because it doesn't seem like the Baltimore Orioles are nearly as talented as Buck Showalter has them playing. So what is it? How come this team can't, you know, rattle off a crazy season like the Baltimore Orioles? Is there something to be said for having a manager who gets the best out of his players, Gary?
Well, I'm a big believer that the manager certainly can help the team's success. You know, I think managers sometimes take the fall when they shouldn't have to. But I also believe in managers getting the most out of certain players and certain ideas that other managers don't. And you use the Baltimore Orioles as a perfect example. You know, the Jays have had some key injuries this year. They've lost Laurie for a big chunk of time, Colby Rasmus, Adam Lynn. They lost Encarnacion at a very important time in that summer stretch. But the Baltimore Orioles have also dealt with injuries.
Huge injuries.
Like season-ending injuries to Manny Machado, Matt Wieters, you know, Chris Davis to his 25-game suspension out. But they're plugging in rookies and nobodies, and they're still winning.
And plus, their big offseason acquisition, Ubaldo Jimenez, has been horrible.
Yep.
And it doesn't seem to matter. And you talk about the Blue Jays' rotation being meh. Well, they've only started 8 guys because they've been extremely healthy. And the Orioles' rotation, nobody's looking at them saying, wow, that's 5 Clayton Kershaws. It's pretty meh as well. So, I don't know, we're not in the clubhouse, right, Dave? Like, we can't tell whether John Gibbons is a motivator or whether you really need to be a motivator when you're talking about professionals, but there does appear to be guys that get something out of not that much.
I think you nailed it right there, though. I mean, at this level, first of all, the coach, the manager, the GM, these are the guys that are always the first to go, always the first to kind of take the brunt because it's easier to replace them than to replace a good player. But I mean, we're talking about the highest level of the sport. I really believe that at this level, you know, you can't be relying on your manager to have to rally your players. You know, these guys are pros. It is on the players to bring themselves up to a big game, to recognize these situations. I think the managerial role does have to do with, like you were saying before, like lineup cards, who you put out when, you know, situational decisions in terms of having to have a guy in there who can bring your guys up to the moment. I think that's on the players.
And it seems like Terry Francona is one of those guys as well. I mean, in Cleveland,
Seems
like for whatever reason now, looks like they're going to miss the playoffs as well. But they were off to such a horrible start. And I don't know, it just seems like there's less discontent. It's not that this Blue Jays clubhouse is rife with guys going at each other, infighting. But I feel like those comments at the non-waiver trade deadline from Jose Bautista and Casey Jansen, I wonder if those happen on other teams. Now, other teams, of course, made moves. Blue Jays did make a move. It wasn't at the deadline. But the Royals didn't make any huge moves. Not to say that Ned Yost is the greatest manager in the world, but it was at a time when this Blue Jays team should have been super positive and pumped up. They'd won their first 4 series after the All-Star break, and then they don't make a move at the deadline, and you get 2 of your key players coming out and making comments. And that pretty much was the turning point in this season. They won that night, but then lost 3-4 in Houston, were horrible in August, and despite a little blip at the beginning of this month, have been brutal since.
So you think that the kind of Jays season has fallen apart because Gibbons hasn't been able to kind of get these guys going the way, as opposed to, I don't know, Edwin going out for a month at a key spot, some of the lineups.
Was huge too. But I mean, it's hard not to point to that moment, because it really, I don't know if that's exactly the reason. I tend to think that maybe that doesn't happen on other teams, but I don't know. It seemed odd to me.
Well, and coming into this season, I mean, we knew that the bench was going to be an issue for the Toronto Blue Jays. There wasn't much depth there. And then you add a few injuries along the year, and it's even more exposed. That weakness becomes a glaring hole.
Yep.
So the fact that the Jays didn't address that, I think you're right. I think that did play a big part in it.
So now it's another, you know, couple weeks at the end of September. You had your meaningful-ish baseball at the beginning of September, apparently, because it is all but done. Although it'd be interesting to see the Mariners in town for 4 games next week, because they have still a ton to play for. And it will be interesting. I mean, Dalton Pompey now getting a little run, started yesterday at Yankee Stadium, went 1-for-4, had his first major league hit, single to right field. That was a cool moment to get that out of the way. I think Travis Snyder had his first major league hit at Yankee Stadium too, if I recall. Yeah, it was like a ringing double to center field over Johnny Damon's head. I don't know why I have that memory implanted in my brain, but That'll be a cool moment for the Mississauga kid. It'll be a cool moment for Blue Jays fans to see him if he does get a couple of starts at Rogers Center here in this homestand against the Mariners, against the Orioles. You're going to get to see, I assume, more of Daniel Norris out of the bullpen. Guys like that. I mean, I guess there are still things to watch if you're a Blue Jays fan, but how bright is the future? We've already seen Marcus Stroman come in this season and be not just an effective part of the rotation, but maybe the Blue Jays' best pitcher at long stretches of times. Aaron Sanchez has been great out of the bullpen. How bright is the future for this team? I mean, it's probably too early to talk about expectations for next year because we don't know what they're going to do in the offseason, but is there reason for optimism, Dave?
You know, I do think you look at a guy like Stroman who has come in and just kind of really, I don't know, I think he's really opened a lot of eyes. I mean, there's a lot of hype about him coming in when he was being called up, but I think he's even surpassed that. I mean, I know for me personally, he's kind of blown me away a little bit with how good he is right away. So yeah, I think you look at him, Sanchez, and it's reason to be really optimistic for the future of this team because they do have a solid core in place to build around, and you just need those kind of peripheral positions to get filled in, and maybe you can do it with these young guys.
I think there's certainly a lot of optimism with the starting rotation next year with these young arms, like you mentioned, Dave. Yeah. My concern is more in those position players.
Right.
Like, you look at that outfield, you know, you can probably platoon Ghost and Pillar in center field, but you can't have them both in your outfield. If Melky doesn't come back, that's another hole in left field. And there's no real, I mean, you know, as much as I love Pompey and I'm excited about the future, ideally he's starting 2015 in the minors.
That's right.
And, you know, you look at second base, that's another big question mark. And there's no prospects there to fill these holes. Now, mind you, these holes are a lot easier to fill on the free agent and trade market than it is to fill your starting
rotation.
And I think
that's what you'll see try to be addressed.
And plus there's the big question mark of Brett Laurie, right? Like, he's kind of the forgotten man this season because he has been injured for such a prolonged period of time, broke the finger of the hand, came back and immediately strained his oblique. He's a guy who really, I mean, throughout his career, he has not been able to stay healthy for whatever reason, whether that's the guy just can't stop playing at 150% and a million miles a minute, or whether he's just unlucky. Is it difficult for this team? Should they still be thinking about planning around having Brett Laurie in the lineup 162 games a year?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, we all know what the expectations were for him when they traded for him. This got to be kind of a cornerstone of your franchise going forward. It hasn't played out like that for all the reasons you mentioned. You got to think they'd give him another crack at it. But yeah, I think his chances are kind of starting to run out.
It seems as well that if you lucked into a couple of players the way the Blue Jays did with Edwin Encarnacion and Jose Bautista, two of the elite right-handed sluggers in all of baseball. And I don't think it's exaggerating to say they absolutely lucked into both guys. Picked up Bautista for basically nothing from the Pirates. Had no idea what they had in him and, you know, hit 50 home runs. Edwin Encarnacion, they DFA'd him at one point when he was a part of this Blue Jays team. He was a throw-in in the Scott Rolen deal from Cincinnati. You got those guys for nothing. That they really haven't had a sniff of the playoffs in their tenure is pretty incredible. Now, a lot of factors go into it, but, and, you know, last year wasn't their fault. Pitching was just horrible. Wasn't the pitching good enough this year? Maybe it wasn't. Like I said, they had eight starters all season long. That's almost unheard of in Major League Baseball. The major starting pitching injury they suffered was very early. It was Brandon Morrow, left for the season, well, only now returning in a relief role. But to be that lucky with injuries in the rotation, how did this team really not, save for that blip in May and then beginning of June, how did this team end up so far out from playoff contention, Gary?
Well, like I said, I'm pointing back to the bench. I think that had to play a big role in it, especially when the injury started happening. When you're losing a regular player like Brett Laurie, like, they were already thin in the infield defense and with those bats in the lineup. So you take Brett Laurie out of there, and that's, you know, that's another big hole, especially defensively, because he's got so much range. He's great in the field. And then you just don't have enough bodies to plug into that lineup when those guys go down. When you lose a bat like Encarnacion or Adam Lind, you can't replace those. And I think, you know, it was also a disappointing year for Colby Rasmus. Like, that's a guy who was coming off a fantastic season in 2013. You're kind of relying him to duplicate that, especially in a contract year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a very tough year for him, and that marriage is pretty much done.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting you bring up, you know, these guys, Bautista and Encarnacion, they're kind of in their primes doing so well. And I think back to Roy Halladay, Carlos Delgado, you know, guys like this who have had these kind of amazing careers and never touched the postseason. And we look at it like it's like a tragic incident. And, you know, you just hope it gets avoided in this case. But I don't know if it will.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting offseason for this team. I think the focus, and rightly so, will be on Melky Cabrera and whether they can re-sign him. But he's going to be, I mean, you look at the free agent class in Major League Baseball, he's up there, probably number one target for a lot of teams, especially in the outfield. Completely remade his value coming off the drug-addled season with the San Francisco Giants. The number of hits and finishing the season with an average over 300 and improved defense, improved base running. If he's not back for this team and they don't find a suitable replacement, I'm with you, Gary. It's one thing to have Anthony Gose and Kevin Pillar in a timeshare in center field. It's probably not even the ideal situation, but you could get by because of the defense they can play and because of the speed and all that. But to have them both in the lineup every day, that's a scary, scary thought. And I'm sure the Blue Jays hopefully don't have to contemplate that scary scenario.
Now, to touch back on the rotation, can you see both Burley and Dickey back on this team in 2015?
It's interesting because, yeah, all right, like they had five guys that were like, yeah, okay, that's fine. But no ace, right? And I think if you're going to deal one of those guys, as much as people like to rip on R.A. Dickey, I think he's the guy with the most value.
I agree.
He's put up some reasonable numbers in the American League East, and if he goes back to the National League, guy can hit a little bit too. So could be interesting in that regard and open up a spot for one of those young pitchers as well. When we come back, the National Football League. Oh, it's been kind of a rough couple of weeks for the folks over there, including Mr. Roger Goodell, who finally emerged from his spider hole the other day to comment on what's gone on. We'll talk about him. We'll talk about the fact that maybe this is going to start actually hurting the NFL in the pocketbook, which could mean that the future of Roger Goodell, yes, is thrown into question. Talk about that. Actually, talk about the games as well a little bit. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live with Dave Zarum, Gary Mello. I'm Ben Ennis on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca.
I got it wrong in the handling of the Ray Rice matter, and I'm sorry for that. I got it wrong on a number of levels, from the process that I led to the decision that I reached.
There you go. That was Roger Goodell, NFL commissioner. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Dave Zarum, Gary Mello. I'm Ben Ennis on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Been a tough couple of weeks for the commissioner of the NFL, as seems like every day there's a new story coming out about some indiscretion by an NFL player. I mean, you had the Ray Rice kicking it all off, Adrian Peterson. The list just goes on and on. Jonathan Dwyer, Greg Hardy. It's ugly, to be sure. I mean, there's no other way around it. It's tainted the league if you didn't think it was already tainted. But the commissioner, after disappearing for a good long while, did finally come out of the woodwork yesterday and address the media, and that was part of it. He got it wrong. He keeps saying he got it wrong. And outside the lines, ESPN, you know, continuing to mount evidence that the NFL knew about what happened in that elevator, had seen the tape of what happened in that elevator. Still, we haven't heard Roger Goodell say, yeah, I saw it. He continues to maintain the fact that he never saw the thing. So overall, guys, after hearing Roger Goodell yesterday, after all that time he spent away from the spotlight, away from the media, are we satisfied with what he said, Gary?
I don't think so. I mean, for one, calling a press conference on a Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, I'm skeptical about that. You know, you're right. Hoping it's going to get lost in the weekend news cycle and as soon as the games kick off on Sunday. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he went out there, and sure, he said he made a mistake. He's made a lot of mistakes, not just a mistake, although he said he made one. And he used all the buzzwords, you know, panel of experts, our policies and procedures and all these things. And that's not what people want to hear right now. They want the truth. They want answers. And, you know, it's come to a point where it's not even about the crime anymore. It's about the cover-up. You know, they keep saying that they didn't see the tape until TMZ released it on September 8th. You know, the Baltimore Ravens have said the same thing. There's all this evidence that people within their offices have seen that footage. So how that video doesn't get to Roger Goodell, I don't know. So I think that's what people want now. You know, this is very much a Watergate scandal for the NFL. So everyone's waiting for Deep Throat to come out and put that tape in front of Roger Goodell.
Yeah, what is it going to take for people to be satisfied with Roger Goodell and not continue to raise an eyebrow whenever he steps to the podium? Is it going to be that moment where he says, you know what, I lied to everybody. I'm a big fat liar. Like, which I don't expect to ever happen, Dave. Like, when will we be satisfied with Roger Goodell?
Honestly, like, probably like if he stepped down from his position, like that's right. What it would take to get the public to really kind of absolve him to a degree. You know, I think as long as he's in that position, it's gonna be hard to ignore, you know, what's happened over the past few weeks and his dealings with that, no matter how long he's in the position. But you know, Gary, you mentioned it's less about the crime now, more about the cover-up. You know, I think all the attention put on this aspect of what's going on, you know, how the NFL has dealt with it, the degree of the penalties and whatnot, I do think at some degree it takes away from, you know, the crimes that are happening here and the conversation that could or should be around that in terms of addressing these kind of bigger problems that a lot of these players are falling into. You know, who, like, it's less about the suspensions. How do we stop these incidents from happening in the first place?
It is an interesting subject when you bring that up, Dave. And it is, I mean, you go back to the Ray Rice thing. The fact that he's, you know, he's not going to serve any time in jail. They had a settlement in place where he had to go to some counseling or whatever. And apparently by the letter of the law, because he's a first time offender, that was how things were supposed to play out. But I don't know. There's part of it that is, I mean, it takes someone, I'm not going to say you have to be crazy to play in the NFL, but you kind of have to be crazy to play in the NFL. Like, it takes a certain type of person to play in the NFL, right? Like, to put yourselves in harm's way week after week, mm-hmm. especially as a running back. Like, you're taking the ball, you're the target for 300-pound dudes to land on top of. Should we be that surprised, like, that there are seemingly more incidents of violence like this among NFL players?
Well, I don't think we should accept it,
you know, no.
as the norm. And I think for every bad guy in the NFL, there you'd hope there's a good guy, you know, as well. Like, they're not all out kind of doing these kind of things. But I mean, yeah, you have to be wired a certain way to play football. But I don't think that's any excuse to kind of go out and do this kind of stuff. And yeah, just how do you get to the root of this problem? You know, how do you address this before the fact and not after the fact? And I don't know how to answer that, but I mean, I think that's kind of the big issue here, more than how long a guy does or doesn't get suspended.
I think the sad part in all this is that we actually had to see the video in order to want to take action. Yeah. Like, the NFL is no stranger to these off-field issues. You know, mm-hmm. in the past, we've somewhat jokingly on sports.ca talked about, you know, we've got a trade tracker, we've got a signing tracker. We almost need an NFL crime tracker in the mm-hmm. offseason to keep up with all these stories. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's not an issue that's new to the NFL. Yeah. The problem is this one tape got out and, you know, it was it was horrifying to actually see what happened inside that elevator. And, you know, the NFL and the Baltimore Ravens probably thought that tape wasn't going to go to the public. So as long as nobody saw that tape, that everyone would be okay with this two-game suspension. So it's sad that it had to come to that for us to even having this discussion.
Right. Do we think that Greg Hardy and Jonathan Dwyer, their crimes are any less significant than Ray Rice? Probably worse.
Yeah.
I mean, but just, there's no video of it. To get back to Roger Goodell, though, and the possibility of him stepping down, which I mean, how do you step away from $40 million a year? It'd be tough to. He's going to have to be pushed if he is no longer going to be the commissioner of the NFL. And the only way I see that happening is if it starts, all these things start affecting the NFL's bottom line. If we start to see more and more companies like Radisson, who suspended their sponsorship of the Minnesota Vikings in light of the Adrian Peterson child abuse story. That created tangible change. The Vikings almost immediately said, Adrian Peterson isn't coming back to this team until this is resolved, mm-hmm. because they saw a tangible effect on the amount of dollars they can bring in to their team. It's going to take something like that to have all 32 owners say, Roger, I know you've made us a ton of money with all these TV deals. You gots to go, because Budweiser or Ford or some car company is pulling out as a sponsor of the NFL. And we've already started to see rumblings. I mean, Budweiser, a couple of other different companies wrote letters to the NFL saying, not even so much that we're appalled at the number of acts that seemingly take place in the NFL, but the handling of them by the NFL. But it is one thing to write a letter, right? It's pretty easy to, it's almost like a hollow threat. It's another thing entirely to do what Radisson did and said, yeah, you know what? I don't know if we're comfortable you standing in front of a sheet with our logo on it as you're talking about child abuse.
I mean, we were talking about it before. I mean, from that perspective, like the NFL has made a Teflon to a degree, right? People will still watch the games. As a result, the league will still generate massive revenues, and advertisers will want to be a part of that for that reason alone. Because, like you said, the bottom line is what I think is the biggest kind of issue for the owners and whatnot. You know, whether we like that or not, that's kind of the reality of the situation. I mean, the irony of a beer company calling out anyone for like morals or ethics.
Yeah, and Arian Foster had some great tweets that too.
Well, I think sadly this won't impact the NFL's bottom line enough for them to be that worried. I mean, I don't, you know, football fans only care about one thing, and that's what's the spread tomorrow. That's all they really care about. I don't think, you know, this, you know, it's been in the news for the last couple of weeks. I don't think it's going to impact ratings tomorrow. I don't think the NFL is selling Super Bowl commercials at a discounted rate this week because of all, you know, all the heat they've well taken. Said. You know, the shield, that NFL shield is almost untouchable.
But isn't there some sort of bonus or public goodwill to be had for that first company, you know, say it is Budweiser, isn't there like something to be said for that company being the first one to say, you know what, we've had it. Enough is enough. We're no longer a sponsor of the NFL. I mean, the second company is whatever, cares about you. But if you're the first big major sponsor of a monolith like the National Football League, aren't you kind of looking at this? And I know it sounds cynical, but I might cover your baby ears. But that's all Budweiser cares about is making money, right? And all these comments, even the letter sent to the NFL. But isn't there a possible tangible effect on their bottom line if they're the first to come out and say, hey, listen, we're taking a moral stance. Enough with the NFL. We're pulling out. Isn't there something to be said for whoever is the first company to do that?
Yeah, I mean, that is really interesting. And you're probably right. People will probably rally around that company for a little while at least. But even then, I feel like, I don't know, maybe I'm cynical. I feel like that would be a financial decision too. You know, it's just another reason to kind of...
Yeah, it would be a financial decision, but it would be a financial decision on the, let's use Budweiser as the example of doing that. Yeah, they're doing it not because they really are taking the moral high ground, right? They think that...
They're going to get more customers.
Right. But then it affects the NFL in a very monetary way as well. And that, I mean, you'd be shocked to see Roger Goodell last 5 minutes if something like that happened, wouldn't you?
See, I disagree, though. I don't think Budweiser pulling out a sponsorship with the NFL would get them more customers. I think it probably affects... I probably think that they make more money remaining associated with the league than they do. I mean, just look at the impact the NFL has on, you know, in the economy and their fans. It's just, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. It's a scenario I have a tough time envisioning as well. Big company like Budweiser pulling out of the NFL, but... I mean, it seems like it's been going on this discussion for a couple of weeks, and it seems like every week there's a new wrinkle to the story. And I'm sure the NFL thought at first, you know, the return of games would kind of take it out of people's minds, but definitely doesn't appear to have worked that way. 11:12 Sportsnet Radio Network. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis, along with Dave Zarum and Gary Mello. Let's talk a little bit about the product on the field, guys. Thursday Nighters. Listen, I think this is what we've learned about Thursday night football, is there going to be sloppy affairs, right? Because you got teams playing on short rest, and they're not exactly 100% prepared. Certainly the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, although they haven't really looked that prepared for anybody. They're 0-3. It was 35-0 at halftime, and it was kind of flipped the TV off at that point. But when it got to 56-0, Dave, like perversely, I kind of went back to that game and I said, I want to see this thing get to like 70-0. I want to see the biggest blowout in NFL history. It kind of got cool at one point.
Yeah, like you go from watching this kind of crappy football game that you can't imagine anyone has any interest in unless you're in Atlanta to suddenly, I might be watching history here. You know, I might see the biggest blowout ever. Yeah, so I guess it's kind of fun in that. But yeah, it seems these Thursday night games are like predestined to kind of not be close.
Yeah, it's it was an ugly game to be sure, and not much going on once the starters got out in the fourth quarter as well.
And it also seemed like, you know, the Bucks, you know, you mentioned them 0-3. I mean, they're just looking rough right now. You know, we heard on the 22 on the update that their quarterback is out. But, you know, they seem to say, like, okay, Matt Ryan and Julio Jones, let's let you guys, you know, we'll try to let you guys do what you want, stop everyone else. And that's, we saw, you know, what a brutal strategy. You got one of the best QB receiver combos just having their way with them. And the result is that score.
Yeah, and it seems like the Falcons are one of those teams that had kind of a mysterious step back last year and could be stepping forward this year. Football in this general area is kind of getting a little more play than it's used to. And I'm talking specifically about the Buffalo Bills, who are 2-0, big divisional win last week against the Miami Dolphins. Big test this week at home against the San Diego Chargers, who knocked off the Seattle Seahawks last week. And maybe this most surprising result of the week two schedule. It's a fan base that's downtrodden, I think, but is finally starting to get a little injection. They are not moving. That team's not going anywhere. The Rodgers bid, along with John Bon Jovi, those guys came up well short of owning the team. Terry Pegula, I mean, he's going to have the key to the city, no question. He saved that franchise, spent $1.4 billion on it to keep it in Buffalo. They're going to redo the stadium. Jim Kelly appears to be healthy. The Bills are 2-0. Unfortunately, you have to live in Buffalo, but everything's coming up Bills, isn't it? You kind of feel for this team. You know, they had the four straight Super Bowls, all losses. Maybe this is finally the time for the Buffalo Bills to return to relevance in the NFL.
No.
Okay.
No. First in the AFC East is a great story, but, you know, and they've been doing it with good defense so far. Like, they held both, you know, the Dolphins and the Bears to, you know, 80 and 86 yards rushing, and, you know, and the special teams has been good. But they've got a tough schedule in the next month. You know, you mentioned San Diego tomorrow. They've got Houston, Detroit, New England. Like, those are some tough games for them. I can't see this lasting. You know, I keep thinking back to a couple of years ago. I think it was 2011. You know, they started with three straight wins. They were like 5-2 through October.
Yeah, right,
and they lost like eight of their nine, you know, the last nine games. So it's the Buffalo Bills. It's really hard to get excited this early.
Yeah, we've definitely been here before. But I mean, you know, you talk about the team staying in Buffalo and you see the kind of the crowd that came out last week, you know, and that was a huge part of their win, I thought. The city's going crazy. That's becoming, you know, one of the toughest stadiums to play at because, you know, you have this fan base knowing, you know, our team's going to stay and the kind of joy that comes behind that. So yeah, I mean, they're playing well on the field, but you kind of, it's, I don't know, I wonder if this team's building some kind of momentum that's bigger than what's happening on the field, you know, and maybe that can carry them further than any of us thought they would go this season.
Bigger cursed sports city, Toronto or Buffalo, right? You had Wide Right, you had the Sabres foot in the crease and whatever, all that. And then you got the Leafs, you know, and you got the Jays, and I know they won a couple of World Series. Who's the more cursed sports city, Buffalo or Toronto?
Those four Super Bowl losses. Sorry, I mean, I don't know how it gets worse than that. That's a gut punch if there ever was one. Yeah. I don't know, to have this kind of stuff happen 4 years in a row. I don't think we've experienced anything like that here.
I'm going to say Toronto only because it's near Buffalo. Yeah. Makes it more cursed.
That's true.
I'm going to go with Cleveland.
This week, the matchup we're all looking forward to, it's a Super Bowl rematch. And it kind of surprised me when I saw the fact that this thing, it doesn't happen all that often that you get a Super Bowl rematch the next year. It's first time in a long time. The Denver Broncos going to Seattle to play the Seahawks. Seahawks get punched in the gut a little bit last week, suffering their first loss of the season. Chargers look great. Just kind of sliced them up last week.
I think Philip Rivers is just kind of one of the more underappreciated guys in the whole league.
Yeah,
it's really fun to watch him play.
Right, and I don't know why he's underappreciated. Maybe it's just like the look he has on his face. He kind of looks petulant. I don't know what it is.
I think it's the, what's it called, Boletto? The cowboy like tie he wears
after
games.
Yeah, the bolo tie.
Bolo tie, that's what it is.
Yeah, so the Seahawks look vulnerable. The Broncos get Wes Welker back after the NFL changes its drug guidelines. Man, you hope that guy doesn't suffer too many more concussions because he's had a ton, but apparently doesn't seem to mind. Broncos have looked more than good through their first two games, 2-0, go to Seattle, play the Seahawks. You know this means more to Denver you would think, the way the Super Bowl went down last year than it does to Seattle. But the Seahawks, after losing their first game of the season, you know, they're going to be pretty fired up as well. I mean, got to be looking forward to this one, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually kind of surprised this isn't, you know, a Sunday night or a Monday night, or
that
it's one of the 4 o'clock games tomorrow. Yeah, you got two teams heavily motivated for their own reasons. You know, I think I've been really impressed with the Broncos so far this season. The way they've been able to, you know, Welker was such a huge part of that passing offense, but we're seeing guys like Julius Thomas really even take his game to another level. I think he's got 4 or 5 touchdowns already. Emmanuel Sanders, who they brought over from Pittsburgh, has been kind of a revelation in that slot role where we've seen Welker in the past. So you add a guy like Welker to that. Plus, you know, their defense is healthy again this year. You have Von Miller back, and they brought in DeMarcus Ware. I think he might be injured tomorrow. But that's a really, really strong team on both sides of the ball. You know, they improved their secondary. So, yeah, I think they're going to be a little more fired up tomorrow, and I could see them taking the whole thing.
I'm really curious to see how Peyton Manning is going to do against that defense, that Seattle defense.
Right.
I mean, you look at his numbers the last 2 years. You know, his average against all teams not named Seattle, he's averaging like 330 pass yards a game. Against Seattle, it's like 280. You know, it'll be interesting to see how he handles it. Although, if you're Peyton Manning, does winning tomorrow really mean anything? Like, it doesn't really erase that horrible performance in the Super Bowl.
They eviscerated him in that Super Bowl. I mean, that was demoralizing.
And you bring up an interesting point. I'm surprised it is a 4 o'clock game on a Sunday. Yeah. You know, the NFL is not known to mishandle anything, so I don't know why they.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Just another misstep. Okay.
Yeah.
Before we go, there might not be another franchise in the NFL happier that there's no focus on them. At least from a controversy standpoint, than that team that plays in Washington with the name thing. Because that was, going into this season, that was almost a top five storyline. This NFL season was, you know, we were hearing Phil Simms wasn't going to say the team name. There were a bunch of broadcasters coming out saying they weren't going to say it. How many people have revisited that conversation? It doesn't exist anymore with all that's going on with Roger Goodell and the discipline problems in the NFL. They're in Philly this week playing the Eagles. No Robert Griffin III, a guy that a lot of people thought would have a tough time staying healthy. Well, I guess you're right. The guy wasn't even tackled and ended up dislocating his ankle. Apparently it's a 6 to 8 week thing, but could be interesting. I mean, there's a possibility that that's the last we ever see of Robert Griffin III with Washington ever.
And there are some people in Washington who will probably tell you that it was kind of a blessing in disguise in a way, in the sense that it gives them an you know, easy opportunity to put in Kirk Cousins, who was kind of his incumbent for a long time. And, you know, there was going to be that quarterback battle there to begin with. And now you don't have to rely on a bad game from Griffin or you know, interceptions and turnovers to pull him out. You have this injury, so he physically can't play. You have no choice but to put Cousins in. So, we might be looking at a situation where Griffin doesn't come back to the team if Cousins can kind of take control, like in the way a lot of people think he can.
Right. If they rattle off, you know, 4 or 5 wins between now and when Robert Griffin III is healthy,
it'd be tough.
It'd be definitely be tough to put him back in there. When we come back, the Raptors open up training camp in just a couple of weeks. DeMar DeRozan going to have a nice little gold medal around his neck when he returns to North America. I assume he's in North America right now, but when he returns to Toronto and the Raptors head out west to start their training camp in BC, be interesting to see how that affects his season. Another year of experience under his belt, playoff experience last year, but also the experience of playing on such a high level with his American teammates at the World Cup of Basketball, winning a gold medal. Does he take a step forward? Where do the Raptors end up after their surprising run to the playoffs and then a Game 7 against the Brooklyn Nets? We'll also get a little word in on the Premier League as action continues on Sportsnet right now. It's Hull leading Newcastle on Sportsnet. And maybe we'll talk about the outlook of the Major League Baseball playoffs as it will not include Toronto Blue Jays. Sorry to break your heart. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis along with Gary Mello and Dave Zarum on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Brett Popplewell.
Secretariat has opened a 22-length lead. He is going to be the Triple Crown winner. Here comes Secretariat.
It was June 9th, 1973. One of the most significant dates in all of sport. The day Secretariat, the fastest horse of all time, won the Triple Crown. Everyone remembers that horse, but how many remember the man who rode him? New Brunswick's most famous son, Ron Turcott. The little man in the white pants who accumulated more than 3,000 wins in a 17-year career. 5 years after winning on Secretariat, Turcott's life changed forever. He was 36 years old, racing around the same track where he'd won the Triple Crown when his horse went down. Turcott was launched from his saddle like a stone fired from a sling. He somersaulted twice as he bounced off the ground, breaking his sternum, dislocating his spinal column, and crushing two of his vertebrae. That was 36 years ago, and he hasn't walked since. There was a time when men in Hollywood wanted to turn his life into a film. He didn't let them. Instead, he shared his story with us. Earlier this summer, I had the privilege of going back to Belmont Park with one of the greatest jockeys who ever lived.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet magazine, available on newsstands now, and for your tablet and mobile phone on Next Issue and in the Apple newsstand.
Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, along with Gary Mello and Dave Zarum. I am Ben Ennis. Raptors training camp getting underway about a week after the Maple Leafs, and they will head out west to Vancouver for the majority of that camp. Going to play some preseason games in Vancouver and Montreal. And one of their key contributors, DeMar DeRozan, has a new piece of hardware. Got a gold medal from the World Cup of Basketball as the Americans absolutely controlled that entire tournament. There's a couple of different storylines or talking points to come out of that thing, Dave. One of them is we thought that the gap was starting to narrow between the rest of the world and the United States. Maybe it was at one point, but maybe it's back to widening again.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly looked that way. I mean, just no competition for the U.S. at all in that tournament. And you know, interesting enough, you know, they put out a team that was perceived to be kind of the weakest USA team in years and this unproven young team. You know, there was no LeBron James, no Kobe, Durant wasn't playing. All these guys weren't playing. It was like a B team for the USA, and they still just decimated everybody. So I think it goes without saying that these guys are just like multiple levels above everybody else.
Why does it seem, though, Gary, that I don't know, international basketball, because we didn't know that the gap would be this wide going into this tournament. Mm-hmm. But honestly, were that many people paying attention to the World Cup of Basketball? Why isn't international basketball really made it on a North American scale? Now, maybe in Europe this tournament was huge, but kind of didn't really show up on many of our radars.
I think it definitely plays better in Europe or in these small South American countries or big South American countries like Brazil and Argentina, because they kind of want to knock off the big team. They want to knock off the U.S. And us, you know, for here in North America, we're kind of tired of watching the U.S. dominate all these tournaments. And it's really tough to get excited for when you look at that lineup. Like you mentioned, a lot of the big names in the NBA missing. You know, we hear the word dream team. We think Jordan, Magic, Bird.
Yeah.
You know, with all due respect to the guys that made this USA team, it's not as sexy a team.
Yeah, no LeBron.
No LeBron. I mean, yeah, guys like Kenneth Faried are the guys you're kind of...
Manimal.
Yeah. I mean, he was fun to watch, but yeah, he doesn't carry the kind of cachet of those other guys. But, you know, in terms of the popularity of it on this side of the water, you know, I think that might change looking at next year, even when Canada becomes a part of this and, you know, should be slated to be fairly competitive in this world. You know, we look at, in the future, all the young guys the Canadians have, you know, Wiggins being the kind of centerpiece of that. You know, maybe that'll help change kind of how we perceive international basketball when we're, for the first time ever, an active part of it.
Yeah, we're all assuming that national team will be good and that, you know, Andrew Wiggins will play for it.
Yeah.
Because he's come out and said that he will. And Steve Nash is going to be running the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, hopefully one day there's, you know, some great rivalry, kind of like hockey, in this continent.
Yeah.
Canada and the United States would be kind of cool to see. But as far as DeMar DeRozan is concerned, and his progression as a basketball player, do we expect any tangible effect from his playing on the big stage of the World Cup of Basketball and earning a gold medal and seeing what it's like to play with some of the elites in the National Basketball Association?
Well, I certainly think playing with, you know, a lot of those guys on that team is going to improve his game. I mean, you know, Masias talked about how a hard worker DeMar is, how many times he goes in late night to take shots in the gym and stuff. So just by osmosis, just by, you know, just playing against good competition, you know, even in practice, I think that'll help DeMar a lot.
Also, like, you look at where this Raptors team is right now, coming off of last season, heading into this season, I think there's no reason to believe that they can't repeat what they did last year. You know, they're coming with just as strong a team, if not stronger. You look at guys like DeMar continuing to develop, Terrence Ross, Jonas Valanciunas, who had an excellent showing at that World Cup. And, you know, just being a part of a winning team, you know, like you mentioned, bringing back that hardware, you'd think that that kind of has an impact on these guys mentally, you know, that kind of winning edge maybe that they need to come back. And that's the kind of mentality I think the whole team is going to have to adopt this year, which is not that they're lucky to be there, not that they want to win, not that they want to get to the playoffs, but they're good enough to go deep in the playoffs and to contend for the top spot in the Eastern Conference. And these kind of experiences kind of help you build up that sort of confidence that I do think really makes a difference.
Now, they set the bar pretty high last year because I think the expectations were pretty low going into last season.
Yeah.
And they went on that great second half run after trading Rudy Gay and obviously that playoff run with, you know, first round series against the Brooklyn Nets. Don't you think that's going to be tougher for them to do this year? I mean, I don't think they're going to catch any teams off guard. I think teams know when they come into the ACC now what they're going to get from the Toronto Raptors. And
the East is better, too.
It is.
I don't know. I look at the Raptors roster, and I think they're just as good as these other teams that we're talking about in the East. I mean,
Cleveland?
They're not as good as Cleveland. Probably not. Who knows how long it takes for them to gel, but they won't be Cleveland. I really like Chicago this year. I think they're going to be really strong. Derrick Rose looked solid in that tournament.
Not spectacular, though, right?
No, I mean, but it was his first time playing ball in like over a year. His shot was off, but the explosiveness, everything else was right there with it.
But you're talking about, yes, and there's no question, Gary, they were surprised. I mean, this was a team we thought was tanking when they traded away Rudy Gay last year, and that's when they went on a crazy run because the ball was actually moving. After the black hole left town, went to Sacramento. But it was gravy for this team. And yes, they made a seventh game of a first-round series against the Brooklyn Nets. But as far as improvements, I mean, did they actually add something tangible to this team? This is essentially the same team going forward. Why should we expect them to be much better than a first-round, maybe marginal second-round playoff team?
Well, you got another year of that backcourt. I think, you know, Lowry and DeRozan, you can make the argument that's the best backcourt in the NBA.
But Lowry had a career year. So are we expecting
in a contract year, yeah.
Are we expecting him to replicate that?
I think you can definitely expect him to replicate what he did last year. I don't think it was an aberration. It was his best season as a pro. But I think he's the kind of guy who's in a comfortable position for the first time. And he seems like a guy who really, that is really like a difference maker for him. But, you know, you talk about whether or not the team improved. You know, they did make a quiet trade that I think will have a big impact when they moved John Sammons to the Atlanta Hawks and brought back Lou Williams. And Lou Williams is a guy coming off the bench who can kind of get you those instant points, instant offense off the bench. And it was a dimension that they were missing last year in terms of the guy who can just kind of, you can give him the ball and produce points. That's something they didn't have. It's a luxury they're going to have this year coming off the bench. They brought James Johnson back, which was a really interesting move because he reportedly, you know, had the feuds with Casey before, but he has a defensive presence that they just didn't have last year. I think Terrence Ross gets better again this year. You bring back another year of improvement for Valanciunas. You know, I do think there's a lot that the roster has to offer.
Yeah, I think the key is going to have to be the development for both Ross and Valanciunas, because last year, especially down that stretch into the playoffs, they relied heavily on DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry. And you saw with Kyle Lowry, he started to get a little banged up in the playoffs.
Yep.
So that's not something he can sustain over an 82-game season and then hope to perform like that in the playoffs again.
And it's another reason why I think, you know, bringing in Williams and re-signing Vasquez, having that kind of depth really does help because, yeah, you don't want to have to rely so many minutes on. I think DeMar was top five in the league for minutes played. And it is a lot to ask those guys to do it 2 years in a row and stay healthy. So, you know, but they have depth in the backcourt to kind of counteract that.
And one thing I really like is that Masai has kind of kept this core together. I think sometimes chemistry is underrated in sports. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you look under, you know, Brian Colangelo, and, you know, the first few years he was here, you know, he made some good moves, but it seemed like it was wholesale changes every offseason. Yep. I think that really hurt the team. So Masai is keeping that core together. He's allowing these young players to develop. I think that speaks volumes.
Listen, they lucked out. They fell backwards into this core. I mean, when they did that Rudy Gay trade, and these are the pieces they got back, Patrick Patterson, Grievous Vasquez. I don't think anyone expected these guys would be future Raptors and a big part of the team going forward. But yeah, credit to Masai for recognizing these guys did make an impact and are worth kind of bringing back.
I mean, not to be the wet blanket. I just wonder and worry that people are getting excited about a team that had, you know, one great flash in the pan, not that they're going to be horrible this year. It should still be a playoff team, but that you had a lot of things going their way last year, not the least of which was a pretty terrible Eastern Conference. right? Outside of the Miami Heat.
But their division got worse this year. I mean, you look at Philadelphia, Boston. I think those are like the two
Philly
worst
could
teams
get worse?
You didn't think it was possible, but they somehow managed to do it. I mean, I think I don't think the East is so strong. I mean, what teams are going to get better? Charlotte maybe a little bit better. Detroit maybe. I mean, there's a lot of bad teams in the East. I think Washington's maybe the biggest threat.
Washington, Chicago's better. Cleveland is now a thing. You know?
I mean, Miami takes a step back, so that also helps. But you imagine.
We expect them to be a playoff team, though, right?
Yeah, but I think you definitely expect the same from the Raptors. I mean, I don't think there's anyone who would say the Raptors are going to be in tough to make the playoffs this season. I mean, they just looking at the other teams around them, I don't see a disparaging kind of gap in talent.
You know, I'm just throwing it out there that it's not no guarantee that this team is as exhilarating as they were last year. Before we move on, though, one of the big things for me in this Raptors team late last season, you saw it a couple of times in the playoffs, and maybe we finally got the answer. That last play of the season for the Raptors, dying seconds of Game 7, is who has the ball when it matters most, right? It was DeMar DeRozan for a little bit there. Kept dribbling it off his foot a couple of times, You know, in Portland. And eventually, I think this team figured out that Kyle Lowry is probably our best answer when we need a bucket late in a game. I guess this is where this team goes into this season as, you know, say what you will about Rudy Gay, but he had some pretty clutch moments and has in his career whenever you need that bucket. And I guess Kyle Lowry's the man now.
Yeah, I think, you know, there was a big chunk last year where that guy was DeRozan, and they gave him some reps. You know, he had his opportunities. Lowry kind of took that position from him. And I think he's kind of your end-of-game go-to guy. I think DeMar is still your go-to scorer, you know, for the first 47 minutes. And then I think Lowry showed that he's kind of got the mental edge to kind of take those shots.
Where I worry a little bit about DeMar this season is having played in that FIBA World Cup this summer is how fatigue will impact his year.
He didn't play much, though, you know?
True enough.
He played, I think, about 10 minutes a game. He was kind of a role player on that team. So who knows?
Yeah, and I remember Vernon Wells, when he played the American team in the World Baseball Classic, had had a career year after getting kind of an extended spring training. Mm-hmm. And already being in game shape is DeMar DeRozan. So could actually benefit him. 11:44 here, Sportsnet Radio Network. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis, Gary Mello, and Dave Zarum. Want to switch focus just a little bit here as Premier League action continues on Sportsnet and Newcastle coming back to tie up Hull at twos as they play in the 89th minute. But Champions League also on Sportsnet earlier in the week, and it's pretty sweet games. I mean, look at Bayern Munich, Manchester City. It's nothing to sneeze at. In Germany, and Bayern coming away with a 1-0 win. Barcelona narrowly coming away with a win at home, 1-0 as well. Chelsea drawing Schalke at home. But I want to talk specifically, Gary, about the English teams, because you know, we think of the Premier League as being the best league in the world. And I think that is true, top to bottom. You know, you can get the Wiggins of the world coming up with some impressive wins, whereas I don't think the bottom half of La Liga or the Bundesliga really has much of a shot on the international stage. So I think top to bottom, the Premier League's probably the best. But you look at the best teams in the world, they're not in the Premier League, are they?
No, not anymore. I mean, I agree that the Premier League is probably the most entertaining league to watch. I think that has a lot to do with the fact that the brand of football, it's a very physical brand of football. So it gives the smaller clubs an ability to go after big teams like the Chelseas and the Man Cities and such. But when you look at Europe as a whole, and English clubs specifically, they've really struggled the last couple of seasons. And you saw it this week. You know, only one of the English teams won, Liverpool, and they needed a penalty kick in the injury time to beat a Bulgarian club.
Right.
You know, but City lost to Bayern, Arsenal lost to Dortmund, Chelsea tied with Schalke, coincidentally all to German clubs.
Right.
So, I mean, I think the shift of power in Europe has really changed. You're seeing the Spanish teams and obviously the German teams that are, I think, really owning that competition.
It is. The Spanish teams are almost a joke. Like, I look at, like, they just, there's not even enough space for some of the names they bring in there, like Luis Suarez, like Gareth Bale, just the biggest names in the world every year. It doesn't matter how many guys you have, whether you're Real Madrid or Barcelona. Apparently, there's always room for another you know, a high-priced guy.
And these things are cyclical. I mean, it, you know, for a while their Italian teams were getting all the big names, and then the English clubs, and, you know, there was a time there where if you didn't have two or three English teams in the semifinals, you were shocked because, you know, they were kind of the world powers. And now you're seeing it with the Spanish clubs.
Is there something for hockey to learn from soccer? I feel like there's a lot of comparisons and a lot of opportunities that the NHL and hockey in particular is missing. You know, whether it's playing some sort of a Champions League, where I don't know if it's the Stanley Cup champs go play the KHL champs, and I don't know if that's necessarily what you do, but something. Isn't there some, I mean, there's some pretty good leagues in Europe. You know, the KHL is able to pay millions of dollars to some of its elite players. Now, if you're in your prime, you're not playing in the KHL. Maybe some guys that are a little bit past, or maybe there are some guys that are over there who are not the upper echelon players. Which I think it'd be kind of cool to see some sort of hockey Champions League where you see the NHL, and it would be so difficult to do in the middle of the season because you're not playing once a week like you are in the Premier League or La Liga or whatever. But I think it would be cool if the NHL did something like that.
You know, I think the key is that you need the competition level to be at least close to where you're at, you know, when you talk about KHL versus the NHL. And that's one of the cool things about soccer is, you know, the Champions League is a really, really neat kind of a concept.
And you will get teams, though, that aren't, you know, shouldn't, like Ludo Goretz should have no business going to Anfield and leading 1-0 late in that game. But there they were. So, I mean, you would have those underdog, great underdog stories of some KHL team. And imagine the atmosphere if the Stanley Cup champion Los Angeles Kings go into, you know, whatever, Stockholm and play the best Swedish elite league team. And, they come away, they go to a shootout or something. I think it'd be pretty cool.
No, I think it'd be really, really neat too. And there would be a lot of cool storylines that would kind of come out of that. I think we'd probably need to blow up the schedule as it exists right now, because I think the one thing about the soccer schedule is that it's built around this Champions League idea, and it seems like everything kind of comes from that.
See, I can never see the NHL going for it, though, because they have nothing to gain
by
going over and playing a KHL team or a Swedish team. It is interesting. Maybe it's something you do with the All-Star game. I mean, the All-Star game seems to be becoming more and more irrelevant every year. Maybe you look at Major League Soccer. They've done that where instead of having, you know, League All-Stars against League All-Stars, they kind of have their best players take on a club from Europe. So maybe that's how, you know, the NHL approaches it.
I believe that's how the AHL does it as well. I think the AHL, or at least they've done a bunch of different things AHL game, but they've brought over teams from Europe to play the AHL All-Stars, which probably seems like a more talent, you know, equal talent when you're looking at it that way.
You know, back in the ABA All-Stars used to play the NBA All-Stars.
Yeah.
And those are some great games. I think there's one game where it was like 145 to 143. You know, I mean, there's definitely potential there. It's a cool idea.
Yeah, I'm all in favor of blowing up the current construct of the All-Star game, especially in the NHL. Outside of the Pro Bowl, probably the worst All-Star game, I would say. The NHL
so
All-Star.
So you don't like the draft? The All-Star draft?
Although that
the
Phil Kessel moment will live. Who was Mr. Irrelevant this year? I don't even remember who it was.
That's a good question. I don't recall.
Yeah, but the...
Phil Kessel will always be Mr. Irrelevant.
He absolutely will. All right, we only got about a minute and a half here. I guess I don't want to open up a whole new can of worms with the Major League Baseball playoffs. So maybe we'll just stick with Champions League and the world of soccer, Gary. After what you saw Champions League this week, man, Real Madrid looked good against FC Basel, whatever, 5-1. Barcelona, not that great. What is your takeaway from the first week of group play in the Champions League?
It's tough. I mean, a lot of clubs struggle to open up, but that's what you would expect for the first week of competition. I think the German teams look pretty strong, and I'm not just saying that because they beat English teams. I think Bayern is probably the team to beat this year. You know, another year under Pep Guardiola, they got a
Portuguese
fantastic.
Teams didn't look that great.
No, they didn't. No, my club gave up a late equalizer, there, especially Benfica. Benfica lost handedly, and my club gave up a late goal as well to lose the result. So we won't talk about that. But, you know, I expect Bayern kind of, and then obviously the Spanish teams. When I say Spanish teams, I mean this year Barcelona and Real Madrid. You look at the players they brought in, it's tough to see them not there in that final four.
And dig Olympiacos with 3 goals. Everybody knows the Greek teams like to score, right?
Yes, exactly.
What? No, 3-2 over Atletico. That was a shocking result as well. Lots of fun times ahead in the world of Champions League. Some of the most entertaining soccer you will see anywhere. Gents, thanks a lot for this. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Anytime. It was fun.
When we come back, I've got an hour of Sportsnet today. We'll talk to Mike Wilner as we get you set for game three of this four-game set against the New York Yankees. We'll also talk to John Crick as week three of the NFL season is upon us. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live alongside Gary Mello and Dave Zarum. I'm Ben Ennis on the Sportsnet Radio Network.